Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome. So we're going to try to cover a lot of things, but there'll be room for questions, and if we can kind of steer it to the things that you're interested in. Pesach is probably one of the more involved holidays. There's more preparation than any other holiday that we have. And it could be that's why it's the most memorable. They've done studies as far as what Jewish practice is a person's favorite, or what do they remember from growing up, or what sticks with them the longest. And the Seder is etched in people's memories. It's that special family time. It's the work that's put into it. What are we supposed to be thinking as we're cleaning our houses? Cleaning is never fun. I mean, it's fun afterwards. It's nice to have everything clean and neat and to have that feeling that we've worked hard and we've worked toward the goal and we've brought our family together. And it's also special in that we're doing the same thing that our grandparents did and their grandparents and their grandparents. And it's a very unique spot in history when you think about it to be sitting down to the same family tradition that has been practiced for thousands of years. You know, in America we go back to the Mayflower. That's recent history. 200 years? That's nothing. You know, we were having Seders, you know, 1,000 years, 2,000 years. They were sitting around in different countries, and the different foods that we have reflect the customs of those countries. Well, the Gemara in Brachos says that as we get rid of chametz, what is chametz? Is the leavening. Pesach, the Torah says that we're supposed to take the five grains, wheat, rye, spelt, oats, and barley, and we're not allowed to let them leaven or to ferment. And the fermentation process is what turns it into bread or into a cracker. And that's where one way to prevent that is to cook it. And that's where we get the matzah crackers or the... So in that fermenting is the idea that there's two ideas that are, there are more than one idea mentioned. One is that when things are simple, they're very special. And we sometimes tend to make things very complex and complicated and add lots of things. And it's really the simple things in life that are what make life special. And you see that sometimes when you can have just, you know, just flour and water, and it's fine. You know, it's really fine, or fruits and vegetables. And you don't need all the preservatives, and you don't need all of the, you know, other fancy things. It's sometimes the simple things getting back to the basics, getting back to our founding as a nation, that's what's important. There's also an idea that sometimes if you leave something too long, it can go sour. In other words, the chametz is where you leave the bread so long that it begins to blow up and it begins to go bad, and we have to get it before it turns into chametz. It takes action. And there are many things in life that require action. You can't just sit back. You can't just let it happen. You know, I was just at the JCC, and they have that big Holocaust memorial, and it says, Zachor, remember. And what we really say when we say never again is that we should never let it happen. That it implies that if enough people had taken action early enough, not necessarily us or not necessarily, you know, if mankind had taken action, it could have been prevented. And chametz symbolizes that you can't just let something stay where it is. Otherwise, it's going to blow up. You have to do something. And so that's also part of the symbolism in the chametz and in the matzah. So as we start getting rid of the chametz, we see that we're trying to go back to our beginning of our nationhood, and also to the idea that we are not going to let things go sour and get spoiled. We're going to take action, and we're going to remember. Okay. So there's two parts of the lecture. One is how to get the kitchen ready for Pesach, and then what kind of foods we can use on Pesach. They're two separate subjects, which is, one is that In some places they build a Pesach kitchen. That's the ultimate. You know, just unlock the door and you go in. And but most of us don't have that luxury. And so we're going into the kitchen that we prepare our regular food on, and we need to get it ready for Pesach. And so you need to know how to turn your kitchen over, which in other words, make it Pesach dik or make it ready for Pesach foods. And then the second part, we'll talk about which foods are kosher with Pesach. And so the first step in the kitchen, and probably the most important thing, is to be organized. And there are some people, it's not necessarily... it's interesting. The best kashrus agency isn't the strictest kashrus agency. It's the most organized. The same thing is true in the kitchen. If you think everything through, there are sometimes people do everything and then they forget something. And that one thing that they forgot can spoil other things, because you get ready to cook or you get ready to serve and you say, oh my goodness, you know, or sometimes, you know, they put something on top of the fridge with a loaf of bread or something up there, whatever it was they forgot. And so you just want to think about what kind of meals you're going to serve, what kind of equipment you're going to use, and which kind of equipment you're not going to use. And so those things that you're not going to use, or for 8 days you're not going to use, you don't really need to worry about so much. You know, it's like a lot of times people, they you know, think the microwave and the bread machine and the toaster and the, it's only 8 days. So exactly what, you know, figure out what it is that you need. Those things you don't need, you can simply close off. And when you, one of the things that's recommended is that we sell any chametz that we might own. And so if we happen to be that, let's say there's some crumbs or there's something that's inside there are some of our equipment, if we just decide we're not going to use it, and we authorize the rabbi to sell any chametz that we might own, so we can just put it away, we can just close the cabinet, we can just not use that for Pesach, and we don't have to worry about it. And then we can focus on the things that we are going to use. And so, in that way, that would make it easy. Some people have a custom not to actually sell chametz, which means they don't sell in their non-Jewish neighbors and their cleaning lady, and they're very lucky. They're going to get lots of good cakes and cookies and crackers and schnapps and whiskey and whatever it is that they don't want. So some people, they would not actually have any of that in their house. They don't want it. Their custom would be to totally eliminate any chametz from their house. That's if you have that custom. Others, and it's perfectly legitimate. If you do not, if that's the way your grandmother, your mother did it, or your father did it, they got rid of all the chametz, so you should do so also. Find a nice neighbor that can use the food. That's great. You're a cleaning lady, you're a handyman, whoever it is. But if you don't have that custom, and you just want to not be guilty of owning bread on Passover or not have the crackers or the cookies, so all you have to do is authorize the rabbi to sell it for you and put it away, so that you won't, by mistake, wake up in the morning and just forget it's Passover. So that would be fine. So you could just, you know, just put that away, figure out what you need, what you don't need. Now, there are other things that we think about also, and that is we don't like to waste food. And it's no, you know, if you don't have that custom, you don't necessarily want to throw it away, or you can't afford to throw it away. Some people will only keep the chametz if they have a significant amount. Some people have some really good whiskey collections. It'd be a shame to just, you know, throw all that away. It took them years to, you know, all the duty-free shops, and they just... So, all right, you know, that's a reason to keep it, so then you would sell it and just make sure to put it away that you won't come across it. You're allowed to divide your fridge or your freezer with, let's say, the products that you can't use now. Like, everybody has half a jar of mayonnaise and half a jar of ketchup and half a jar. And on Pesach, we don't want to use anything that might have a crumb. Now, Pesach is unique in that we're even worried about a crumb, even a tiny bit. We, you know, Hashem went very, for us, as a nation, He did everything. He took care of everything. We not only had the 10 plagues, and we not only saw retribution on the Egyptians, but he really took us out in a grand fashion. And therefore we celebrate Pesach in a royal fashion. And we don't even want a crumb of chametz. So anything that was used during the year, we have to sell or get rid of. So if you get rid of it, great. If it's too difficult and it would be a challenge, so you can sell it. So you can sell that mayonnaise jar and that ketchup and that mustard and all the condiments and that. So what you would want to do is you would want to make sure that you won't come by mistake to grab it on one morning when you woke up and you just forgot. So what you can do is you can put it in a bag, you can tape it up, you can put it in the bottom drawer of your fridge, you can put foil over it, whatever you can do so that you won't grab it by mistake. And then, like we said, authorize the rabbi to sell it. And then that would be fine. So just take all of those things that are used during the rest of the year, your ketchup, your mayonnaise, your all the condiments, put them in a drawer, put them in a corner of your freezer, tape it up, put some paper around it so that nobody will come to use it by mistake. And then you're fine. Now you can begin to bring your Pesach stuff in. The refrigerator and the freezer itself just needs a cleaning. In other words, just a basic cleaning. You don't need to line it with foil. Now, if you would put a hot pot in the fridge, in other words, let's say you've got a pot of hot chicken soup and you want to go to sleep and you cooked it, and you don't want to leave it out all night because then it'll get warm and it'll get ruined, but you want to put it in the fridge. So you shouldn't really put a hot Pesach pot straight on your fridge that had hot hummus pots. So then just put a napkin or a cloth or something down. That's where you'd want to line your fridge. But if you try to line your fridge before Pesach, then the air won't flow through. And you'll have all kinds of trouble sometimes, depending on how the fridge is made. There's a certain aerodynamic that keeps the air flowing in different directions and stuff. So before Pesach, you just want to clean it, just spritz it and clean it, wipe out the shelves and everything. And you don't need to cover it unless you plan on putting a hot pot down. And if you do, so then put something down underneath when you do that. That's what you would want to do as far as the fridge itself. And the same thing with the freezer. And like we said, you're allowed to have a hummus section as long as it's roped off, if it's sealed off. Cabinets that you don't need to use, just tape them closed, seal them, you know, and again, have in mind to sell any hummus that you forgot to clean or might be there. Those cabinets that you would like to use for Pesach, a basic cleaning. Cleaner is great. In other words, what happens if there are crumbs there? If you sprayed it with a cleaner so the crumbs are no longer edible, that's sufficient. So if you have like a spray cleaner or whatever, and you spray the crumbs, so even if there was food there, technically you have not violated Pesach by owning crumbs, because those crumbs have been nuked. You've hit them with the crumbs. Sometimes on fridges they have like there's the area in between the fridge and the door where all the crumbs like to fall. So it's very good to use those crumbs with a good spray cleaner, you know, or you can try to get them out, but sometimes they're difficult to get out. But as long as you know that if there was crumbs, they're no longer edible, that would be fine. And that's the same thing is true when you wash your floor. You don't have to go down on the floor and look for crumbs, but if you've washed your floor with a cleaner, so that's made any kind of crumb has been treated with a chemical, then you no longer need to worry about it, and that would be fine. Now, some people have a custom on Pesach that if silverware or something hits the floor, they don't put it back on the table. It's not a bad idea. Some people do that year round. They don't put it, you know, I won't talk about what restaurants do, you know, or not. It depends on your favorite place. But some people, they have that custom. If something hits the floor, they would wash it off first. But technically, as long as you wash the floor with a chemical, you wouldn't have to do that. Carpets are a little more difficult. Like, you never know if the carpet was totally clean, was it not clean. Some people steam clean. That's where that custom comes from. If you dropped, you know, you dropped your silverware, or you dropped it on the floor. The most difficult thing to clean in a house is the oven. So when they designed the self-cleaning oven, that was the greatest thing, because self-cleaning is self-kashering. So if your oven is self-cleaning, you're ready for Pesach. You're good to go. So clean it and you're good. They have something called continuous clean. Continuous clean is not as good as self-cleaning. There's still schmutz in a lot of continuous clean ovens. Even though the salesman told you it works, it doesn't always work. So what do you do? So you have to, it's a continuous clean oven, which means it doesn't have that shield that goes on in the cleaning cycle. What you have to do is you have to clean the dirty part yourself. Now, the only problem is that on a continuous clean oven, you have to be careful. If you use very heavy chemicals, it can hurt the heating elements, so you have to read your manual and know what kind of. But at the end of the day, if you're if you've tried cleaning and you've tried scrubbing it and you've tried twice and it's not coming out, then you don't have to do anything else. Meaning that there are times when the metal oxidates and it's just discolored and there's nothing you can do about it. You can scrub and scrub and scrub and it won't come out. If you've tried that and you hit it with a strong chemical and you tried twice and it's not coming out, that's sufficient. If it is coming out, that's when it's the problem, because then you have to keep on cleaning until you get it all out. Now in a self-cleaning oven, you don't have to worry about that because it gets so hot that it's going to incinerate any of that schmutz. But in the non-self-cleaning oven, you've got to actually clean it because it's not going to incinerate it. The oven won't get hot enough to do that. That's the basic difference between the self-cleaning oven and the non-self-cleaning oven. What about your stove? How do you clean the stove? So the stove, there's two parts of the stove. There's the stove with the burners, and then there's the area in between. I don't know what you call that, the area in between the burners. Okay. So the burners themselves, if it's an electric oven, or electric stove, you just turn it till it gets red. 2-3 minutes. As soon as it's red hot, you're good to go. You're ready for Pesach on the burner area. If it's a gas stove, also you could turn on the flame for 2-3 minutes, and the flame will burn the area where the flame hit. The only challenge on today's gas stoves are they make these tripods that stick out way beyond the flame to hold the big pot. And the problem is that when you turn on the flame doesn't necessarily hit the entire area where the tripod is. And so what you could do is that you can move the tripod, you can have part of it over the flame, and then you can move it so that the other part gets hit by the flame. You can 2 or 3 steps, and there was 5 minutes on each spot, that would do it. You could take the whole tripod and put it in your oven when you kosher the oven. That would do it also. You could take like a blech or like a piece of sheet metal or a very big pot and put it on the tripod and put the flame on. And what that will do is that'll keep the high heat on the entire area under the pot, and then that would make it hot enough that it would be kashered. And so again, there are a few different ways to get the entire tripod of the stove kashered, and then that area is kosher with Pesach. Now the problem is, what about the middle area in between the tripod? So that's a little bit of a challenge. Most stoves are made of material that you can't kasher for Pesach. And the truth is, most stoves are not kosher year-round in the middle area. Why? Because you make an egg for breakfast and the eggs sizzle, and they spritz dairy from the eggs, from your cheese omelet, gets spritzed on the middle of the stove. And then when you have your steak for supper, it spritzes grease in the same spot. Well, if you have milk spritzing there and meat spritzing there, it becomes non-kosher. So it's never really a good idea to put food or hot utensils down directly on the middle of your stove. So that should really be avoided year-round and Pesach also. The easiest thing to do is just to cover it. If you have an all glass top, you have to be careful because sometimes when you cover it, some of the glass tops will get scratched. You have to read your owner's manual. I've covered mine for many years and it hasn't gotten scratched, but you could just be careful not to use that area. In other words, if you have a glass top, just stick to the area where the burners are. Don't use that middle area at all. See, the problem with a glass top is it's very easy for a pot to slide to the middle. When you're using a tripod, that's not going to happen. So some people like to try to set up a trivet or something so their pot wouldn't slide to that middle area. So you have your oven and you have your stove, kosher with Pesach. You have your refrigerator, you have your cabinets, they're all basic cleaning. What about your countertops? So if they're natural stone or stainless steel, you could just pour boiling water on them and kosher your countertop, your sink, your table. But some of this don't have natural, the only natural stone today is granite. What else do they have? So there's some other kinds of materials. They've come up with all kinds of modern materials. If you have one, one of the newer ones, The Chicago Rabbinical Council has a whole list on their website of which material is smooth enough and natural enough that all you need to do is pour boiling water, and which material, like some of the rubber vinyl ones, are a little bit trickier, so you just have to cover them. There's so again, if you have either stainless steel or a natural stone, then you can just pour boiling water on your countertop. If it's not a natural matter, then it just needs to be covered. Now, depending on whether you need a waterproof covering, and that depends on how you use your countertop. Like some countertops, you don't really put hot food or wet food on, but if you're going to put wet food on, so then you'll need something like a little thicker, or it just depends on... But the old-fashioned, you know, what do they use, wrapping paper, or the sticky paper, or whatever works for you as far as covering the counters. There are all kinds of, everybody remembers the tinfoil or cardboard or whatever you want to put on your countertop is fine, really, as long as it's covered. And the same thing is true of the table, but again, if you're going to put something hot and wet, so then you need waterproof, you know, something plastic or something that's going to keep... Yes?
Is there a different decision on the steamer that people use on their countertop?
It depends on the material. If it's a granite countertop, then potentially that would be fine. The method of kashering, which is interesting, after all these years, it's the same sterilization method they use in Hasbro, is boiling water. It's the most, you know, that's still the ideal method of kashering is with boiling water. If your sink is stainless steel, which most sinks are steel, so then you can kasher it by pouring boiling water in it. Now, many of us don't have a dairy sink and we don't have a meat sink. So you're going to pour dairy and you're going to pour meat in, which means anyway your sink is not going to be kosher, so you're going to be using bins. So if you're going to be using bins, you're just going to use plastic bins anyway, so there's really no special process you would need to use for your sink. So that's your oven, your stove. Your broiler is a little more complicated. Let's say you broil fried chicken, or I don't know what you broil, and you like to pour some good steak sauce that has some really good Jack Daniel's hummus in it, right? They make a Jack Daniel's steak sauce. So the problem with the broiler is the broiler needs a different kind of kashering. I'm talking about like a separate broiling drawer most people just don't kasher their broiler for Pesach. They just don't use that drawer. Sometimes you could take that little broiler tray out and you can get a new one just for Pesach. Then we could talk about that. But that would be a little more complicated to use that broiler tray underneath or whatever. The best thing would be just not to use just to kasher the oven, not actually the broiler on Pesach. That's the basic, kitchen items. Let's see. Now then we get to equipment. So you have, dishes cannot be kashered for Pesach, unfortunately. Any kind of china cannot be kashered for Pesach. And we don't kasher plastic for Pesach either. So basically the only thing you can really kasher for Pesach is metal. So you can kasher your silverware. And you can kasher your pots and pans if you need to. How do you kasher things that can first? There are three steps to kashering. Some shuls, I don't know if they do it, Ariel. Do they do a kashering here? Like some synagogues will get a very large kettle. And the advantage is that the ideal form of kashering is to dip something in boiling water. Well, what if your pot is too big to fit into your kashering pot? So a lot of times what the shuls will do is they'll get a really large pot and do a kashering, and everybody can bring their pots and pans to the shul and they'll dip them for you. But it's also, they have the big strong gloves so you don't burn yourself, and it's just much quicker, much easier to, and you have a big fire so that you don't lose that flame. If you don't have that, I know they do that in Beth Jacob as well. But if you have that available, so you can just bring your pots and pans and your silverware and your utensils and bring them here. They'll dip them for you, and you take them home, and they're kosher for Pesach. If you don't have that, you got to do it yourself. So what you need to do is you need to have a large pot. So there's three steps. First step is the item that you're going to dip has to be clean. It should not have been used for 24 hours with chametz, and you need to bring it to a rolling boil. Meaning the water in the boil, the water is moving when it boils, and then you can drop, you dunk the item into the pot until, now when you first put something into a pot of boiling water, the boil sometimes stops. And so it stops boiling, so you put it in, you wait a few seconds till it reboils. And then when it's still boiling, then you can take it out and then it's ready. You could do it half. Like sometimes they have these really long spoons, so you could dunk half, wait till it reboils, and then flip it around, and you could then dunk the other half. Now, you don't need to retake it to the mikvah. In other words, once something was taken to the mikvah, once it's in the mikvah, that's fine. Even if you make it was not kosher to Pesach, that has nothing to do with it. This is strictly koshering it for Pesach. One bonus of Pesach, not too many bonuses, and that is year-round we don't switch from milk to meat. They're not supposed to switch. Like one day you say, well, I have a milk spoon, I'm going to use it for meat tomorrow. You're not supposed to do that because it's too confusing. But you're allowed to use a milk spoon for fleshik Pesach. Or Pesach, because Pesach is like so totally different that you're allowed to actually switch from milk to meat, you know, for the utensils and the, yes. Mm-hmm.
In the cleaning process of the pot, you have to take the handles off.
Depends on the pot. If the handles are separate, then they should come off.
But that screw that's hard to get to, and you have to take it off. And
yeah, so, the problem when the handles are a separate piece, when the handles are part of the pot, then you don't got to take them off. But when they're a separate piece, there's a crack in between the pot and the handle. And food actually gets in between that crack, so then you would want to take the handle off and then dip it in. Yeah. So that's just a quick summary. Let's take two or three questions, or maybe more, and then we'll get to the basic food questions. Yes.
It sounds like sometimes you can use soap, sometimes you can boil, sometimes you can't do any of them. What's the differentiation? How do you know when soap is okay and when it's not?
If it was not used with heat, for example in the fridge, or you're just talking about like the knob or the handle, so then a soap cleaner is fine. If it's direct food contact, then you need to a koshering process.
So if it's you have to boil it.
Yes, correct. The only exception would be like bake pans, which that actually needs, since you actually cook directly on a bake pan, there the boiling won't help. And you would actually need like a blowtorch to make it red, and that would ruin it.
I'll put it in something you haven't.
If that won't ruin it. You got to be careful with some of the aluminums and things, because they could, you know, they don't do that well in the soap thing. Yeah. So, yeah.
When you pour boiling water and you stay in the same grinder, and it comes off, you also have to wait 24 hours. Before you do that?
Since it was last used with half comets, yeah. In the ideal. One thing about pouring boiling water, and that has to do with the technique, since I'm using a visual here, let's pretend this is the kettle of boiling water we're using, okay? So, and let's pretend this is the sink or the countertop. So some people, they like to throw the water, and the water will like go all the way down the sink and the counter. But the problem is, if you ever experiment with it, when the water first hits, it's very hot, but by the time it rolls down the end of the counter, it's not hot anymore. It's amazing how quickly it cools off. So an ideal koshering is you pour a little bit like this and you walk with it. In other words, you go back and forth rather than pushing the water over, like, you know, just tossing it and letting it flow. You pour like small amounts on the, in a sink it's not really hard. On a long counter, that's what you'd want to do. It's a good idea to have towels around also. And another step I've learned from experience is you start out further away and then you get closer. And trust me, otherwise the water will, you could hurt yourself. In other words, you start out, you kosher the furthest part, and then you work your way in towards the closer part, and then that would be the better way to go.
If the counter's never heated, why are you using boiling water?
That's correct. If you never use your counter with anything hot, the problem would be if you'd want to put hot food on the counter, if hot food ever goes directly on. If something hot is never going to touch the counter, then you're right. It just depends on, you know, trying to think if your matzah brei is going to fall on the counter or whatever, you know. People typically cover it as the safety, but it just depends. Some people, the Covering is not great because sometimes food gets stuck under the covers, and then you have to recover it in the middle of Pesach, and it just depends on the method of covering it. So if you're never going to, it's easy to cover it, but the challenge is if you use it a lot, especially with foil, like water gets underneath and food gets underneath, and then you want to recover it. And so people like it when they can just do something that they don't have to cover it at all. And so that's where you get a stainless steel can or the dishwashers, we'll just mention it.
What about laminate counters?
So most, I would recommend looking at the Chicago Rabbinical Council. They go into different, I think plain laminate we usually would not kosher. But there are different names for, they have like 15 different names, and silestone and this and that. And they have all the fancy names for the, if it's a plastic, then we would just cover it. Some kind of newspapers, tin foil, we used to use funny, you know, whatever wrapping paper was on sale with, you know, the old, you know, whatever you could find, you just put down and it works. So, yeah. Okay. Sticky paper, like people like to use, like the contact paper. Okay, let's talk about Pesach food a little bit. So before we...
Dishwasher,
thank you. So the only kind of dishwasher you could really kosher for Pesach would be a stainless steel dishwasher. The other dishwashers have like a plastic and they have a porcelain interior, and those are stuff that we don't kosher for Pesach. If you do have stainless steel, so then in theory, if you had different racks, you could kosher it for Pesach. And you can talk to me privately, we can go through how to clean it well. But if it's not stainless steel, then we really can't kosher the dishwasher for Pesach. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. If your oven grates get ruined by putting them on self-clean, like they get parts moved in and out, they kind of get... Is there another alternative to kosher them?
You talking about the stovetop grates?
No, the oven grates.
Oh, the oven grates themselves. You don't have to actually put this oven grate through the self-cleaning cycle. You could just burn them out in the oven on high for 40 minutes.
Oh.
See, the self-cleaning cycle gets to like 1,000 degrees, or not even, that gets to 800-900 degrees, whereas... And the reason why it needs that heat is because it incinerates any of the grease or other stuff that's still in the oven. Whereas if you just needed to, if that was too hot for the veneer on your rack, then you wouldn't, especially if they're clean already, then you could just do it to 400-500 and for 40 minutes and that would be fine. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And hopefully that wouldn't ruin it. Probably not. It's usually the 800-900 degrees that really warps them and... that some of the manufacturers recommend to take them out. Let's talk about food. Before we talk about human food, let's talk about pet food. Pesach is unique that not only are we not allowed to eat chametz, we're not allowed to own chametz, and we're not even supposed to benefit from chametz. And so the challenge is a lot of pet food actually has real chametz in it. And so it's a real challenge, and we think we're picky. Some certain pets are used to a diet. They just... So some pets, they like real food. You know, they're happy on Pesach if they can have real. There are lists, and on the kosher websites, you can find lists of what you can feed your pet for Pesach. Pets, in human food, there's the original Torah prohibitions, the wheat, rice, felt, oats, and barley. And then there are different foods that over the years have become customary not to use. And it really depends also what countries your ancestors were from, but pets, they don't have those customs. So pets are allowed to have rice, and they're allowed to have corn, and they're Sephardim. They're allowed to have beans, and that's no problem. One interesting thing is most of us aren't used to reading what's in the pet food, and believe it or not, a lot of pet food has milk and meat, and you're not supposed to benefit from milk or meat also. So if you notice that in your pet food is milk and meat, so it's not a Pesach problem, but you're really not supposed to benefit from milk and meat. You're not supposed to cook a kid in its mother's milk, which is exactly what they did if they have milk and meat. So the good news is, that's only milk and meat. You're not supposed to cook a child in his mother's milk. But bacon and milk, you could have. Or, because it's a pig, and or some other animal, camel and the horse, or whatever, you know, as long as it's, but I wasn't going to write that in the thing, that bacon and milk was kosher, but it's okay for pet food. And they say also for your fish, if you can give them shrimp instead of the grain that they have as the fish food. But, so again, they have, as long as you're not feeding them the five grains, wheat, rice, salt, oats, or barley, then that's fine for the pet food. What some people have to do, because when the pets get older, you really can't change their diet, or that there are some people will actually sell their pet to the neighbor for Pesach, and you have to mention that to the rabbi so he knows how to make the sale. And then you sell them the food too. You give them the food, and then they would take care of it. Or it gets to be what we call a shaila, how to work it out. But you really don't want to benefit from chametz on Pesach, and so even what you feed your pets, you have to be concerned with, or to think about a little bit. Okay, that's as far as pets. But let's get to human food, the important stuff here. Okay, so it used to be food was pretty simple. There was, you know, fresh fruits and vegetables and meat and potatoes, and you know, things were exactly how they seemed. Today, processed food has lots of additives. And because of that, there's very few processed foods that you can use for Pesach unless they have a special Pesach mark. The most common thing is that they add preservatives to almost all processed foods, so they have a long shelf life. They last forever, right? It's the, how is it still soft after so, because they add, when you think about it, how is the fruit? You have a fruit at home, it lasts 3-4 days, and you go to the store and that dried fruit lasts for months because they add preservatives. Most of the preservatives are corn-based, and we don't use preservatives on Pesach. And so it would only, any processed food pretty much needs a Pesach texture. There are a few exceptions. One thing, all oils are processed except extra virgin olive oil. That's non-processed. So you can buy any extra virgin olive oil for Pesach. It doesn't need a special taste. It actually doesn't need a regular hashkafa either. That's a very pure product. It's like the first press of the olive oil. So that, whereas other oils, they have to refine. They have to take the sediment out, and they have to cook it, and they add things to it. Pure cane sugar, also no. In other words, regular sugar is also no problem for Pesach. Regular salt is no problem for Pesach, but they add a very important ingredient, iodine. I don't know why. I think it's certain sicknesses people get if they don't have the... So for Pesach, though, we use non-iodized salt. It doesn't have to have OUP or anything. Just make sure it's non-iodized. Spices. So I've actually been to spice companies, and believe it or not, they don't clean out the spices in between one run and another. And when they make spices... When they grind spices, they make these blends, they use breadcrumbs, and they use to add to the, so we, on a ground spice, we recommend only buying with an OUP, because they don't clean out the grinder, and again, even one crumb we would try to avoid for Pesach. On a whole spice, then you don't have to worry about it, because it's not ground. It doesn't go through that grinder where they don't clean out the in-between. Obviously, if you can go to the Pesach aisle and just get, you know, the one that has the pea, that's a good thing. I noticed it's become more popular. They have that you grind your own spice. They have a lot of, you can just buy those for Pesach, because those are not ground. They're inexpensive. They're like, because Pesach products are always more expensive. So you can buy like a pepper bowls or, you know, any of those different things that are whole spices and grind your own. It'll be very fresh for Pesach. Milk. Milk itself is naturally kosher with Pesach. There are some vitamins that they add to milk, but and the vitamins may or may not be kosher with Pesach. But our view is that as long as it was bought before Pesach, that would be fine because it's a very small amount. We actually supervise the Kroger milk that they use kosher with Pesach vitamins. That's like the biggest supermarket area. A month before Pesach, they get in kosher with Pesach vitamins and they swish. All the Gentiles are drinking kosher Pesach milk for the whole month. So, not the chocolate milk, just the regular white milk. Yes?
Why
did
you buy it before Pesach? Why you mentioned several times?
Yeah. So, The reason why is that before Pesach, if there's a tiny amount of something that we wouldn't use, it becomes nullified before Pesach. But once Pesach hits, and you have a crumb, even if it's a very small amount, it doesn't become nullified. So you're always better if you buy it before Pesach. That's the advantage. The other advantage, and this has to do with milk and with eggs, and it goes to the idea that we mentioned earlier, that we don't want to benefit from chametz, and they feed the cows grain. So in theory, they might have fed the cow grain and then milked it. Or they might have fed the chicken grain and then it laid the egg. So now, that's just an extra, like, strictness or a custom that's developed. So if you run out of eggs or milk, you can go buy more. But ideally, we try to buy the eggs and milk beforehand, or you can buy the special milk that, like I said, that we do at the Pesach run, which would be fine. The AKC, the Kroger milk has an AKCP on the date code. So, yeah.
What about almond milk or nut milk? Is it kosher?
Yeah, so all, the, most of the, well, soy milk would be, soy is something that Jews from the European countries don't use on Pesach. There is a soy milk in the OU book for Sephardim. If you're a Sephardic Jew from Syria or Egypt or Morocco, that you can use. It's in the OU, you know, that's a soy milk. Almond milk, I haven't looked into. Chances are they're probably processed to some degree, or they have other ingredients. I'd have to see. I'm not aware of that. I do know that they list some soy milk for the Sephardim that they could use. But I don't know about most of the baby formulas do have some. The good news is most of the baby formulas, the Similac, they don't have wheat, rice, spelt, oats, or barley. But they do have some of the corn products in them. So the only thing is, for little children, especially a baby, since they need their formula and it wouldn't be good for their health to take them off it, so they are allowed. They get a pass on the custom of the corn, wheat, spelt, oats, and barley. And most of the baby formulas are in the Pesach book, which we have that too if you want to look it up. And we have a list of the baby formulas as well. There's a new food that they discovered about 8 years ago in the rainforest in South America called quinoa. And it's a superfood. It's like good for you. It doesn't have any of the bad stuff, or at least until they find out it doesn't have any of the bad stuff in it. It's good for you. And it's not a grain, but it's something else besides meat and potatoes that you can serve on Pesach. So it became very popular. And it didn't have. It's actually like a root, like a beetroot. It's in that kind of family, and you just buy it by the bag. And they say it tastes a little bit like rice, or a little bit. And it is very popular for Pesach. And it is there's no particular. It's not one of the five grains, so it's usable. This year there was a big alert about it because they discovered that the main packing plant for quinoa also packed barley, and occasionally the barley seeds would get into the quinoa. So they're recommending if you use quinoa to stick to Bolivian quinoa, because in Bolivia they don't pack barley, they do it straight in the rainforest. And I checked, most of the quinoa I've seen is from Bolivia. I don't know why, I don't know that. But either way, they just recommend looking through it to make sure that it doesn't have any grains mixed in. One of the things that we see is that the lawyers got there first. They met on the packaging. They would say, made in the facility that packages, you know, may have wheat or grain, because they know in those kind of facilities, it's impossible not to have something mixed in. And so some people this year are a little more cautious about quinoa than in previous years. Our position is, as long as it's a Bolivian one and you make sure there's no grains in it, that would be fine.
Is it obvious when you're looking at it that you see a grain version? Okay.
Pretty much, yeah. you could see, like, sometimes there'll be things that you don't know what they are, but it's obvious that it doesn't belong. It could be a twig, it could be it's not all uniform, so occasionally you'll just see something, just take it out.
The quinoa doesn't look like a rice or anything.
I don't know how to describe it. It looks like little pieces. But you could see if there's a grain in there, you'd be able to see it. You could tell barley or grain. Yeah.
It's got wild rice. It's really not rice. It comes from
some other reed or something like that, but it's not right.
Yes, I think Jews from Europe don't use wild rice either. I'm pretty sure that they don't. I don't know why, and I'm not sure exactly why. There are a lot of these things that we're not sure how the customs developed. One of the reasons was even certain things they were made bread out of. They had like cornbread, or they used it like bread. And then there are other items in the farms in ancient times, even in today's times, they use virtually the same equipment for harvesting and storing products. In other words, first they'll go and they'll harvest the grain, and then they'll go and they'll harvest the next product, and it goes through the same silos and the same farmer's utensils, and it is relatively common to have grain mixed in, and so therefore unless there's a system to keep it separate, then it would be avoided. And so over time they're just, but I'm pretty sure we don't use the wild rice either, even though it's technically not a rice. Okay. Let's see what else we have here. Meat. Meat is kosher with Pesach year-round, except for cold cuts and hot dogs, because those meats are not just meat. There are flavorings, there are all kinds of other stuff they put in there. You don't want to know what they put in there. There's also what they call fillers. Fillers are potentially grain, even. It's not a pure meat product. So they make kosher with Pesach hot dogs and cold cuts and things, which are pure meat products, or they use matzah meal instead of whatever fillers they were using. But regular meat is kosher with Pesach year-round, and regular fish is kosher with Pesach year-round. So any raw fish or meat would be kosher with Pesach year-round, as long as it's not a cold cut or a hot dog or something like that. There are dyes that they use in fish for coloring, but they give it to the fish when they're alive. So it's okay. In other words, the fish swallow the coloring when they're... It's given to the fish. They have to put it on the label, but since they actually ate it when they were alive, it's not a chametz problem, whatever the coloring would be on the fish or on the product. Most plastics and aluminum foils are fine. There's no Pesach problem with plastics or aluminum foils. There is a problem with starch, especially today where recycling is very big. So a lot of the papers, though, they use a starch to make the paper thick. And there's actually a wheat starch. And so some people will avoid a plain white paper plate. In other words, a styrofoam plate is fine, a plastic plate is fine. Some people would prefer, would use a paper plate as long as they have a coating on it. Because this way, if there's a starch, you're safe because you've covered that starch with that picture coating on the top. And then there's some people, extra strict if they're worried that the starch might bleed through the picture coating. So they wouldn't use a coated plate unless they used it with a really hot food or something. The good news is Kroger, Publix, and Dixie all are don't use wheat starch. And so if you're using the Kroger coated paper plates or the Dixie or the Publix one, it's fine. And even if you use the regular one, since it's coated, most people would say it's okay. But we just say the plain white plate that has the straight starch should be avoided on Pesach. Yeah.
What about wax paper and parchment paper?
Those typically are fine for Pesach.
What about sugarcane butter plates?
What's it called?
It's sugarcane butter. Instead of using paper mold, mm-hmm. they use the fiber from sugar cane, mm-hmm. and they break it down into pulp just like mm-hmm. paper, and then they form it into a plate.
Is there any kind of starch there, or does the sugar cane have a natural stiffness to it, or?
I don't know whether there's starch in it or not.
Yeah.
I'm not sure. It's probably all right. Most of these things are okay, but if there's a kind of starch in it, especially if it's recycled, then you want to be careful with it.
Yes, it's not starch.
Okay, yeah.
Back to grains. Do you know about millet?
Millet would be avoided on paper. Yeah.
Can you repeat about the
Dixie
Publix and
Kroger
paper plates?
Yeah, they're all kosher with paper, so they're fine.
Hostess?
What?
Even from hostess,
yeah. Even if you want to be extra strict and worry about that the starch might go through the coating, though it happens to be they don't use wheat starch. So they're actually in the OU book. Even though there's no tea on the label, they're fine. Any tea is kosher with Pesach. Any flavored tea, that's a different story. Because flavorings use alcohol and they use other stuff. But any pure tea, no problem for Pesach. Decaf is also a different story. There's something, when they use decaf, there's something in the decaf process that's a problem. Yes?
Are all Heksher products considered as being like OUP this time of year? Or, like, for example, this is OU, it's not OUP. But when I look at the ingredients, I don't see any hummus. Mm-hmm. So are all Heksher products considered, or?
So this is where it gets challenging. There's two sections in the OU book. So one section is the products that are kosher with Pesach, even though there's no pea. And then the other section is the products that are only kosher with Pesach with a pea.
Oh.
So the only thing is, to be out in the section without the pea, it's like bottled water, tea bag, like very simple things. It's sugar. I didn't know if it would be anything.
When you check ingredients, you can't really rely on that because maybe there's hummus on the plant.
Correct. Well, most things are cooked. They go through a pasteurizer, and so if it goes through a pasteurizer, you don't know. Even honey, it's interesting. We recommend a pea on honey. It's easy to find honey with a pea. Why? Because what a lot of companies do is that, see, the honey comes from bees, and the bees pollinate different flowers. And so naturally, one batch of honey would not be as sweet as another batch because it would be a different season and a different kind of flower. So, but if you go to the store, you like a certain flavor of a certain honey because it's not too sweet or it is too sweet, so you want it to taste the same next time. So what the companies do is they have a test, that they test the sweetness of the honey, and if a certain batch of honey isn't sweet enough, they can adjust the sugar so that this honey will be just as sweet as the other batch of honey. And the way they do that is they add corn sugar. And they don't list it as an ingredient, because technically they're just making this honey as sweet as their regular honey. In other words, if this particular honey was from a batch where the flowers were too soon or with the wrong kind of acidity, so all they do is they call it just adjusting the level of sugar. And so it may have corn sugar in it, and therefore it would be best avoided on Pesach unless it has a tea. And so there are a lot of things like that. The process that they use, we discover they add a preservative. There are some people that suggest not to use baby carrots on Pesach. Why? They use preservatives in baby carrots. Because once they peel off the carrot, it's going to turn brown. So what they do is they add a preservative in the water so that once they peel it, it'll look nice and red, nice and shiny. So we actually take the position that AKC is the best acceptable, because even if they use the preservative in the water, it's a very small amount per million, and it's still a very, it might be corn, but it might be, there's other kind of preservatives also. And as long as you bought it before Pesach, we take the view you can buy the baby carrots. But I just wanted to show, like, it's so hard to know, like, something you never suspect that there's a corn derivative in it, or there's a preservative, or that. It's just amazing in the food industry how many things are complicated. Almonds go through a pasteurizer. I don't know why, I don't know how, but they do. Google it, you'll see. They just, everything, they want to make sure that there's no germs, and there's no this, and there's no that. And so that's why we're cautious. Raw nuts are no problem for Pesach, as long as it doesn't have any of those preservatives, the BHT or the, some other initials that we avoid as well. Frozen vegetables. Now they make pasta on the same equipment that they make frozen vegetables, and every now and then there could be like a little noodle or a little piece of rice that would be in the frozen vegetable. So frozen vegetables would not be recommended without an OUP, for Pesach. Frozen fruit, should be fine. They don't make any noodles in the frozen fruit plant. And so frozen fruits, as long as it's just pure frozen fruit, should be no problem. Juice. So the truth is most orange juice is made in milk plants. And the problem is they don't make the orange juice on the same line as they make the regular milk. Because the way they work it, in milk plants they have these big expensive pasteurizers which can heat up to very high temperatures very quickly. It kills all the germs. And they have like one line, one or two lines that are dedicated to milk. And then, on the other line, they do the smaller volume items in the dairy. They do the orange juice, the chocolate milk, the vitamin milk, the eggnog. The problem is, chocolate milk uses malted. It uses a malt, which is real common. It's a grain. So if they run the chocolate milk and then the orange juice right afterwards, so then the orange juice is cooked in the same thing as hummus. And so that's why Tropicana is the big famous orange juice for Passover, because it has OUP. They are a totally orange juice company. They don't run milk on the same line. We do the Kroger orange juice, and we make sure for Pesach they don't run the chocolate milk first. So the Kroger orange juice, we have an AKCP on it if you want to avoid that problem. But it's just an idea that when we're really not aware of how the food that we eat, all the things that are done to it, and Hashem went, has taken care of us in such a great way, and we are so thankful at this time of year that it's like He went the extra 9 yards for us and for the Jewish people. So throughout the ages, we've been very careful with Pesach, and we do our best to really try to avoid any of the comments. Okay, we'll take a few more questions publicly, and then you can ask private questions if you want.
Why is there a separation between the Ashkenazi and Sephardi of what they can and can't? Like,
Kinos,
is that the word?
Yeah. Some of it had to do with how things were made in those countries. In other words, it could be in some countries they went through the same equipment and the same silos and the same farms, and in other countries they didn't. And it could be in some countries they made them into bread and they mixed it with bread, and then in other countries they didn't. In other words, the Jews lived in this country separate for hundreds of years. Now it's really the first time where we've gotten back together, which is, in other words, today in the same synagogue we can pray with Jews that are from Syria and Egypt and Iran and Iraq, and that's miraculous, because for hundreds of years we were like, they just developed totally separate. And so they develop different customs. One thing that's interesting, like haroses, like every community has their ingredients for the haroses is a staple plant, it's supposed to look like mortar. So it's interesting, every country you go to, they have a different recipe for what are the right fruits. And basically, those are the fruits that were available to them in their marketplaces when they went. Today, you can go to an international market, you can pick whatever you'd like, but it's just what develops over time, pretty much.
So the prohibition on eating like beans or corn, I mean, corn seems to come up a lot in the conversation tonight.
Mm-hmm.
Why is it not okay?
So the in the European countries, the farms where they had the corn, I don't even know if they had corn in Egypt and Syria and Iraq, so it could be they never forbid it because it was not something that they came across.
Mm-hmm.
Or it could be that it didn't go through the same process. In other words, if they used it in bread or they mixed flour in with it in the European countries, so then the rabbis would forbid buying it. Whereas if in the Sephardic countries they didn't have a corn dish, they didn't have a corn tortilla or whatever it was, so they didn't see any reason to forbid it.
Okay.
Why is vitamin C then?
What?
Vitamin C?
Mm-hmm.
Why can't you use that on the
paper? When they turn something into a supplement, so they add other ingredients.
Oh, okay.
So you have to make sure the other ingredients are kosher with paper. So there are two vitamin C's that are on the list. They use a lot of times to get the pills. They use a starch or they use another. But vitamin C itself is kosher. Even the kids with more juice would be fine.
Can I use
if it was used during the year, if you wanted to dip it in boiling water.
What about the stand, you know?
Yes. So the stand itself just needs to be cleaned well, but then the beaters and the mixers, so they just need to be dipped in boiling water for the most part. If they can't be cleaned well, then you wouldn't be able to use them. It's interesting, dough hook is pretty easy to clean, even though it's used for dough. But some of the whips have these little indentations that are very difficult to clean in the little holes where the indentation, you know, where the... So if you can't clean it well, then you can't dip it in boiling water. But if you can clean it and make sure that those little indentations are clean, then you'll be able to dip it in boiling water. Yeah.
Hot pot that you use on Shabbos?
Like a percolator, you mean? Or
the hot pot that you
plastic?
Have water in,
mm-hmm,
for some,
mm-hmm,
if that's all that's been in there?
So that's an interesting question. We debated back and forth. We didn't have it on here. Some people feel that the hot pots are really kosher with Pesach year round because they're not around crumbs, especially the ones without spouts. They have hot pot. You know, if you have like the spouts and you have like a cup of soup or chocolate milk where the spout sticks in, that would be a problem. But if you don't really have a spout and it's just a hot pot of boiling water, the challenge is how if it's washed around crumbs. So if it never comes into contact with crumbs year-round, then it wouldn't need a special Pesach kashering. If it's washed with crumbs, it goes through the, you know, it's some people keep their challahs warm on their hot pot. Then it would be a problem. It just depends on how it moves. Okay, if you have a wonderful kosher Pesach, and then like I said, you feel free if you have questions you can ask. And we feel free to call the office as well or email us if you have any Pesach questions.
Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to torahmediaatlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.